The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 104. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. I am super, super excited about this conversation. We just went over some notes of some things that we're going to discuss. And guys, I can tell you right now, this is going to blow your mind. So Jason Burek from Wall Street for Main Street, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you, George. And I am humbled, honored, and excited to be back on with my favorite ass-kicking YouTuber.
There you go. Thank you very much for that compliment. That means a lot coming from you. You are an OG in the biz, that's for sure. But speaking of being an OG, I know we were talking about the Fed audit. I know you've interviewed Ron Paul four times. That's like my dream. I would love to interview Ron Paul. Hopefully we'll get a chance to do that one day. But the Fed audit they did, or they tried to do back 2008, 2009. So can you dive into that and kind of give us the details there?
So first, we have to talk about what really happened in 2008 and 2009, and it's taken years to actually figure that out and put the pieces together. So the Federal Reserve on their website and their reports claims that only about $600 billion in currency swap lines were extended at the height of the crisis in 2008, 2009. I can tell you from research from the Ron Paul one-time partial audit that we got in 2011 and also a Bloomberg News Freedom of Information Act request that is complete and total. It is a complete and total lie. It is economic propaganda. So Ron Paul, as many of your listeners know, has been fighting for an audit the Fed. He wants to end the Fed, but his compromise is to audit the Fed to prove to people that the Federal Reserve is giving out all these bailouts without transparency, handing out, picking winners and losers, bailing out hedge funds and banks for a very long time. Well, finally, the pitchforks and torches, Republicans and Democrats in both houses of Congress, Bernie Sanders and John McCain actually agreed to a one-time partial audit. I believe it came out in 2011 from the GAO, Government Accountability Office. And in that audit, what we found out was astounding. We found out that the Fed had given out emergency loans and currency swap lines, guarantees basically, to foreign banks, foreign central banks, foreign governments, foreign corporations, multinational corporations. And this is because the derivatives, the total amount of derivatives blew up. So we had trillions of dollars. I've seen research reports where there's over $5 trillion in derivatives blew up in 2008 and 2009, and also leverage. So the banks and hedge funds and obviously AIG, because AIG was selling naked credit default swaps, they did not reserve any cash reserves for the losses of the credit default swaps. So it was total system meltdown. The system totally collapsed. In 2008, there was many trillions in derivatives losses, counterparties didn't trust each other. And so the Fed had to step in. And what we found out with the Ron Paul one-time partial audit was that $19 trillion was committed total. The majority of which, I think it's around 8 or 9 trillion, went to the European Union and European banks. But it went to other G7 central banks and banks and countries.
And just to give that some context, this is at the same time when the Fed is telling us their balance sheet is, what, $800 billion? Or was that into QE1 by then?
It had already started, but the excuse the Fed gets with the currency swaps is that they're only temporary and that they could come off. And what Ron Paul said in the interviews was that over a 1 or 2 year period after the economy started to resume in end of 2009 and 2010 and 11, the Fed started to panic about how much liquidity they had injected to prevent deflation and total system collapse, derivatives from melting down. So tens of trillions of dollars in guarantees were committed by the Fed. Now, here's the scary part, George. That was only a partial audit. We found out even more information later than that from Bloomberg News on a Freedom of Information Act request or FOIA request. And the Fed's lawyers have fought all this. So they fought all these things tooth and nail. They've claimed that this is national security. that we are not entitled as taxpayers to look at this, that it threatens the dollar and threatens national security. And what we actually found out, there was over 30,000 documents released after a court battle, Bloomberg News got, and they didn't do a good job of going through the 30,000 documents because I think there was political motivations there because Obama was in the White House, and they lowballed the number, and they said it was around 7 point something trillion had been guaranteed to get the economy restarted in 2008-09. But the Levy Institute went through most of those documents, like tens of thousands of documents, and wrote a research report going into details about all the different alphabet soup of bailout programs and the currency swaps. And the Levy Institute said, and you can look this up, it's on their website, you can do a video about this later, $29 trillion in guarantees were issued. When you add everything up, their best guess, and they spent a lot of time on this, was $29 trillion. To get the system restarted, because the system had totally collapsed from total amount of debt, leverage from the banks and hedge funds and AIG and derivatives that had blown up trillions of dollars.
They guaranteed basically credit lines for that much. I wonder how much was used. Did they go into that in the report?
I'm not sure if we'll ever find out. We would need another audit.
Yeah,
so
right.
The fact that the Fed even was willing to guarantee that much is insane. The other scary part about this, George, is the lack of transparency. So about a month ago, I was searching on Google for Ron Paul Fed audit, and the articles about the one-time partial Fed audit, and there used to be a lot of them from Zero Hedge and Lou Rockwell and many, many others, they're basically all gone. They have been scrubbed. Someone paid to have them removed. If your listeners go to, I think I found a mention of it on page 6 or 7 of search. It took me a long time. I think I found the Lou Rockwell article, and most people are not going to go 6 or 7 pages deep on search. And on the first page of search, there's an article from PolitiFact bashing Dr. Ron Paul, saying that he lies about the Fed and he made up all that stuff and the Fed audit was a lie. Well, Ron Paul has actually read the audit documents. So, and I've interviewed him about this. So I don't know what more they have to prove that the Fed audit did happen and that Ron Paul read the Fed audit documents and that much was guaranteed to prevent when the system did collapse, to restart the system.
Yeah. I read somewhere online the other day that government agency that you referred to, and this was just a blog post, so it might have been way off, but they said they do kind of like a mini audit of the Fed. I don't know if it's annually or something like that, but there again, it's done by the government. So I mean, that's like the mob auditing the mob. I mean, it's like and correct me if I'm wrong, but even that partial audit that Ron Paul got was done by the government agency, wasn't it?
Yes. It's still a good start, but it was only a partial audit. And the Fed's lawyers, like Ron Paul, has talked about this a lot, and he should talk about this even more because of how it's scrubbed now from search. The Fed's
I want an independent third party to do a full audit on the Fed, and I want that group headed by you and Chris Irons from Quote the Raven. That's the only way I'm going to be happy. That would be great. We'd get right down to the bottom of it, and it'd be extremely entertaining throughout.
Yeah, that would be a perfect world, but I am not holding my breath. I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately. I think things are headed the opposite direction.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. It's just getting crazy in the States right now. So let's move on to some bank accounting. We touched on that briefly before we started recording, and you found some just amazing things going back to the GFC number one as well here.
So a lot of financial professionals and analysts now, they either don't know, don't care, or they intentionally leave out that the crazy accounting rules changes, and now the accounting is very aggressive compared to what it was even a decade ago. So the banks back then were able, and this was one of the reasons, besides all the alphabet soup of bailout programs and the currency swap lines and all the bailouts, one of the major reasons why the stock market rallied and why the banks were able to start doing loans again and making profits was because the accounting rules were changed for the banks, allowing them to basically get away with phony accounting or fraudulent accounting. So instead of marking their assets to market, so marking down losses, the banks were able to mark to model. So that was marked to fantasy. They could basically take whatever they thought the value of an asset was on their balance sheet and count it as that rather than marking it down. For your listeners who are not familiar with accounting. So rather than being honest about what the market would pay for an asset, so let's say the asset, it was a mortgage-backed security that the Fed had decided to not buy, or let's say it was some type of commercial paper that the Fed had decided to not buy at the time, and it was really worth maybe 10 or 20 cents on the dollar, the banks were allowed to count it as 100 cents on the dollar, which meant made their balance sheets look better, which allowed the banks to use that as collateral to go and do even more loans or bets all over the world in different types of markets.
Right. So you always get to claim it's worth what you paid for it at a minimum. At a minimum. Yeah. So that just allows them, I guess that gives them so much more balance sheet capacity to go out and do things that we don't even know about. And that's why we have over a quadrillion now of derivatives, dollar-based derivatives. And then you combine that too with the bank reserves. You know, that's one thing that shocked me the other day when I researched it, Jason, is the excess reserves now are, if my memory serves me right, I think it's over $3 trillion in excess reserves. So that just... And again, just to be clear for the viewers or the listeners, that doesn't mean that they will go ahead and lend out those actual bank reserves, but it just gives them massive amounts of balance sheet capacity to go into repo, to create loans, to really financialize the economy. Do you want to talk about that, or do you want to go straight into the main focus of the discussion? And that's the whole craziness with how our entire economy in the United States has been financialized by these banks and the Fed.
Well, the banks really love derivatives. They really love to use the reserves as collateral and then to go and gamble, leverage up, either borrow in the dollar funding markets, which is euro dollar is part of it, or repo, and then so leverage for even more profits like a hedge fund, and then go and gamble in derivatives or gamble in leverage currency trades or gamble in leverage bond trades. So it is extremely dangerous when they do that because the derivatives market, the total size, the estimates on the derivatives market have changed. The last time I looked at it was for an article for my Patreon account contributors, an extensive one about the derivatives market and the euro dollar and dollar funding that's behind the paywall for only $5 a month. But it was around $500 trillion in gross. But the problem with that, George, and $3 trillion in reserves at the Fed sounds like a lot. But as soon as one or two large banks or a couple hedge funds fail, because of the size of the derivatives market, you're looking at total system failure. And in my opinion, there is no useful purpose in society whatsoever for derivatives markets to be that large, for banks and hedge funds and even central banks now to go and gamble with derivatives on interest rates or currencies or commodities. It's just not useful at all to society. But the reason the banks love it, George, number one, it's opaque. And number two, it's a separate casino that the average person on Main Street doesn't know or understand about. And also the banks make extra tens of billions of dollars per year in profits off of this. And then the profits are privatized. So the derivatives traders get to, and the firm, the bank or hedge fund that's trading it gets to keep the profits. And then when things do blow up, like long-term capital management or in 2008, 2009, or with hedge funds that blew up in February and March. And I heard from bond fund managers and my contacts at ratings agencies that that's exactly what happened. Leverage borrowing from funding in repo and dollar funding, euro dollar markets, taking that leverage with loans that is supposed to be safe and be able to be paid back and leveraging up and going and trading in derivatives and foreign currencies and leverage bond trades.
Yeah. And I think the easiest way for the average person to understand what you were saying about why the banks like these types of transactions are credit default swaps, because it's just so blatantly obvious. It's just a side bet. It's just like I go to you and say, hey, Jason, I'll bet you that this happens or this doesn't happen. And you say, yeah, I'll take that bet. And how much you want to put down? Oh, let's do $1 trillion. Okay, fantastic. And you don't have to have, whoever is the insurance provider in that case, you want to look at it that way, they don't have to have the $1 trillion. They don't, you know, they just, sure, I'll take the bet. And then you can just go to infinity and beyond, just keep that going. You don't have to have any capital. You don't have to have any bank reserves. And then I'm not sure, though, how it looks on their balance sheet, if that's an actual asset on their balance sheet that they can therefore leverage into more financial instruments. Do you know how that works? So as an example, going back to the credit default swap, if I'm the insurance provider on the credit default swap, am I able to say, okay, well, since I'm getting a premium on this, now that's an asset on my balance sheet, and I can go ahead and use that as collateral to do some other side bet?
I think normally what these banks and insurance companies, when they sell derivatives products, they tell everyone on CNBC and their shareholders that everything is hedged or netted out. So it's just repeated ad nauseum, but all it takes is one counterparty failing. And because of the total size of the derivatives market, all it takes is a couple trillion dollars in derivatives to fail before one or two counterparties starts to fail, and then their counterparties start to fail. Right. And you see the daisy chain, the chain reaction, and then the central banks start to panic. And then you go to a point where in February and March, the bond markets, the corporate bond markets, the investment grade corporate bond markets at a certain point, George, they went no bid. I mean, yeah. I was told by a bond fund manager that the investment grade corporates in mid to late February and March, they had gone no bid, 90% sellers, because of the amount of leverage in the system.
Yeah, and the spreads even on treasuries were getting real extreme, weren't they?
Yep. Yep, but that's because the global economy was also not functioning. And when Lynn Alden has talked about this too, when the global economy is functioning, we're on a dollar standard. And when global trade is normal, these emerging market countries and foreign companies that are doing well in global trade, they take those dollars that they earn and they stash them in treasuries. And that was not happening.
Right, right. Okay, so then another thing that we discussed that I think really blow people's mind is you've done some like investigative work on this. I mean, it's really, really impressive. But some of the central banks around the world are now turning into these quasi hedge funds where they're also trying to privatize gains and socialize losses. And the socialized losses would, I guess, in their minds come from the Fed. And that leads me to the question of asking, okay, well, who owns these central banks? I mean, is it something like the Fed where, who knows? I mean, it's supposed to be privately owned. And if it is it the bankers that own the Fed? Do they get the shares? I don't know if you saw my video the other day, but I dove into this whole ownership thing. And where do the profits go that the Fed makes? Everyone assumes, just because we repeat it over and over and over again, that all the profits go to the Treasury. But that's not exactly true. If you start peeling back the layers of the onion, you see it's not just a 6% dividend. There could be quite a bit more. And there's a lot of gray area, to say the least. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole before we address what you were talking about with these other central banks kind of being used as hedge funds. Can you dive into that?
So everything is totally financialized, and people bring this up all the time, but a lot of people don't fully explain what it means. What it means is, for decades, the financial sector, so that's banks, investment banks, hedge funds, and other financial entities, have been siphoning off a lot of the profits from the real economy and trading a bunch of paper. A lot of it's in the derivatives market or foreign currency trading or bond trading. And the financialization process, what has really happened, I think, in the last 10 years, and that's where a lot of the stories has really started accelerating, especially in the last couple of years, is you're seeing what would normally have been conservative investors, long-term conservative investors in the past, like pension funds, university endowments, insurance companies, because of central banks like Fed manipulating interest rates lower and causing financial repression, they can't meet anything close to their investment goals. Look at the stock bull market we've had, and a pension fund the size of CalPERS is still drastically underfunded. Well, what has CalPERS announced recently? They announced that they're going to be leveraging up their assets under management by 20% increase in leverage of the total assets under management, and that they're going to be doing risk parity trade, which is a hedge fund trading strategy where where they leverage up on bond trades, on corporate bonds or government bonds.
Right. In which, by the way, Chris Cole has proven that that strategy is highly, highly flawed if we go into a deleveraging cycle, which we're most likely going into.
Yes, I totally agree. Now, I didn't get to talk about central banks. So central banks, we're learning details now. The central bankers, there's hubris. They're getting too cocky. Last year, there was a speech out by a Australian central banker, Reserve Bank of Australia, where he was bragging to, I guess, a bunch of other central bankers or regular large money center bankers about the leveraged currency trades and leveraged bond trades that the Reserve Bank of Australia was doing and how it was easy to make profits off a basis trade, which is a leveraged bond trade, and in currency trading too. And then recently...
But where would those profits go? Like, let's say the Australian central bank makes $100 billion in these hedge fund type of bets. Where does the profit go? Does it go to their, I mean, do they have shareholders like the Fed supposedly, or does it go to their treasury, or does it just go into a black box where we never see it again, and all the people working at the central bank are driving Ferraris? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think this is why we need more transparency here. We need audits of these different central banks. My educated guess is they're doing these other trades to try to offset losses on derivatives, because Martin North has talked about the derivatives position of a lot of the largest Australian banks, their derivative position in real estate, mortgage-backed security, and other derivatives, and how that has exploded. There's many trillions there. So I would not be surprised if they're making other profitable trades in currencies and bonds to try to put out some derivatives trades that are blowing up, because the Fed doesn't want to go in and have to back with many, many trillions all these bad bets all the time. Plus, there's a pound of flesh to a lot of these currency swap bailouts that happen. So the press releases from Fed say that they're giving out currency swap lines at like 50 basis points or 25 basis points, but that's not the full story. Nomi Prins, who is a former managing director at Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns, her last book, she wrote the book called Rigged, How the Central Bankers Rigged the World. And as part of the research, she actually flew down to Brazil and Mexico, and she interviewed current and former central bankers before the book came out for research. And that's not the story. The central bankers were saying how, like, Ben Bernanke was threatening them and demanding a pound of flesh in exchange for the currency swap lines to help with the bailouts, and that they had to do what he said.
What's an example of a pound of flesh? I mean, I get the term, but is there a concrete example of what Bernanke was telling them needed to happen?
Yeah, my educated guess on that from past U.S. trade deals would be some type of either investment into the U.S. by their largest foreign companies, or resource concessions, or some type of beneficial trade deal. Remember, one of the main reasons, a lot of people forget this, with the Plaza Accord and why Ronald Reagan agreed with his trade representatives to devalue the dollar was because Japan and Germany wanted the dollar devalued. They had too much dollar denominated debt. But in exchange for that, Japan, which their main company at that time was Toyota, they had to move factories into the US. So the trade concession was factories and jobs come back to the US from Toyota.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, is it safe to assume that your position is whenever the Fed does something for a central bank, we'll just use swap lines as an example, there's always something behind the scenes that the Fed is saying, okay, we'll do this for you, but you need to do this for us type thing.
Yes. So they issue a press release saying that we're just giving out currency swap lines. It's a short-term loan. It's only like 25 basis points or 50 basis points. The money will be paid back shortly. But the Fed can also, at its sole discretion, this is very subjective to the Fed, because they can just forgive the loans to whoever or whenever they want. And I think that's what happened when the Fed gave out currency swap lines in 2008, 2009. They started forgiving the loans fairly shortly after that. That's what Ron Paul said over about a two-year period.
Wow. Makes you ask the question if they're doing it now. I mean, the same thing. You know, I actually did a live stream on my forum with Lynn last night, Lynn Alden, and we were talking about the swap lines, and they have been used a lot, But she used a chart going back to 2008 where you saw that heavy spike with the swap line usage, and then it kind of dropped down substantially. But you kind of scratch your head and say, well, you know, did it go down substantially because it was paid off? Or to your point, because the Fed just canceled the debt because of some behind-the-scenes favor that we don't know about? I mean, I guess kind of where my mind goes is back to the dollar being the world reserve currency. And the only way the Fed can really do this and get away with using all this leverage, for lack of a better word, mob type of leverage, is if, because the dollar is the world reserve currency. There's so much dollar denominated debt. But if that wasn't the case, I mean, I'm just trying to really get outside the box and think, how would the United States, how would the economy look? How would our monetary position look if another country was the center of the economic universe? And instead of everyone having to play by our rules, we had to play by their rules. I mean, how much different does that world look, or how much different does that domestic economy in the United States look if that were the case? What do you think?
I think there's a lot of people, a lot of powerful entities in other countries and foreign companies that benefit from the status quo. Honestly, George, when I look at the current system, there's over $250 trillion in total debt. And this was before the crisis started, the most recent crisis started in February and March. So $250 trillion in total debt mathematically can't be paid back. So yes, there's a lot of assets in the economy. When things are normal before the global pandemic, there was cash flows. But mathematically, that 250 and now more than that trillion cannot be paid back. And yet more debt is being issued. More currency is being issued. And the currency is debt-based fiat currency, digital debt-based fiat currency. So I view this system, George, as
it creates more demand for the currency. Just to clarify, sorry to cut you off, Jason, but just for the viewers, that the more currency, the whole point of what Jason just said is that there's, as you issue more debt in that currency, it creates more demand for that currency as well.
Also, they want to, when they issue more debt, they try to change the interest rates on the debt on the old debt. So they're trying to, it's a Ponzi scheme. Basically a Ponzi scheme. It's going to sound crazy, but if you're trying to solve a debt problem with more debt and you're issuing debt-based currency and the amount keeps growing and you know it can never be paid back, that to me sounds like a Ponzi scheme.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
One thing I'd like you to address, and I think you've articulated this very well, everyone goes back and forth between Luke Groman and Brent Johnson as far as dollar bears, dollar bulls. But I think you kind of landed right in the middle, and you had, it wasn't a dollar milkshake theory, but it was this dollar tug of war theory. And I thought that it was very well said. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. And first of all, I think the dollar milkshake already happened. I think we already had our version of the October 1929 crash, and we're having, everything is condensed. What happened from October 1929 to 1937, everything has been condensed into about 5 months. So That is crazy. But the dollar tug of war, there's two very powerful forces. So you have the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, you have the academic, the Keynesian academics, who all view this neo-mercantilist view that a weaker currency is required. President Trump has tweeted about it a lot. And on the other side is the amount of dollar-denominated debt, and there is demand for dollars outside the United States, in the euro-dollar, in dollar funding markets, in order to pay back that dollar-denominated debt, or at least make the payments. So these two conflicting forces are pulling back and forth, and this is why the dollar index has been range-bound for a while. Now, I'm a historian, and I've studied a lot of financial history, and history won't necessarily repeat, but it will rhyme. So I think the best comparison, and if you want to look at past empires, there was coin clipping. So there was versions of stagflation where coins were clipped. It wasn't hyperinflation. So the governments just cheated, right? They clipped some coins here or there so most people wouldn't notice. And that was, I would call that a version of stagflation back then with metal coinage. Mm-hmm. But with the British Empire, George, I think that's our most accurate comparison. And the British Empire, what they did, and the British Empire had what I call stagflate and tax and lie. And this is involved with the dollar tug of war too, where they don't want a lot of people to notice that the dollar is being devalued along with all these other currencies, because everyone's trying to devalue in the race to debase. And right. The British Empire, what they did was they just lopped off. There was 4 devaluations, I think, from 1931 to the mid-1970s, when George Soros and Stanley Druckenmiller broke the trading ban, the exchange trading ban, and blew up the British pound on the exchange rate. But the British government actually did massive devaluations over that period to deal with debt. And there was high inflation, stagflation, there was high unemployment, there was high taxes. There was also, during those time periods over, what, 4 or so decades, there was periods of deflation. However, when there was deflation, the governments, the central banks, and by then, I think in the 60s, I'm pretty sure it was the 60s. I'm trying to remember this offhand. I don't have it right in front of me. But the British government had nationalized the Bank of England. And really, over the last 4 or 5 months, that's what's happening, is this is kind of endgame scenario where the Treasury and the central bank are merging to try to protect each other, because they realize that things are getting really, really dicey with the U.S. government finances and MMT. And we're getting to the point now where the dollar tug of war, people are getting more and more desperate to try to the people on the weaker dollar side are getting more and more desperate. Trump is talking about payroll tax cuts, which are just ridiculous, because 36% of the annual tax revenue budget for projected is payroll taxes. But Trump wants to cut that. And then they're talking about the next round of MMT checks, probably. Oh, I don't know.
Jason, I just did a video on this yesterday. Did you hear about the it's called TRIP? This is something that's being proposed. Of course, it's a stupid acronym that, like, the Fed always uses, but it's being proposed in, I guess, the next stimulus round. Did you hear about that?
So this is the $4,000 restaurant or travel tax credit.
Yeah. Is that the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard in your life? I still can't believe it.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I've lived in the Washington, D.C. metro area for 20 years now. And honestly, like, the waste, fraud, corruption, and abuse here from all the federal government agencies is nuts. The average American doesn't understand it at all. But this brings me back to the TRIP example. This is just one of countless examples of what I call rule number one. Whenever there's a crisis, the politicians, the central bankers, the overpaid, overpowerful, tin pot dictator, overlord bureaucrats will just change the rules. And this is what you're seeing now. This is why shorting stocks, George, only worked for maybe 8 weeks. There was a really short time period where shorting stocks actually worked. And then I know you listened to that podcast with Grant Williams and Bill Fleckenstein, and then Mark Cohodes and Bill Fleckenstein were saying, we don't know if we can short stocks anymore, that if they're just going to keep changing the rules to make sure that shorts lose, because everything is financialized, everything is over leveraged. And Luke Roman has talked about this. When the asset prices drop 5%, the reason they panic is because you have these pension funds leveraged up like hedge funds, because you have these university endowments leveraged up like hedge funds, because you have these central banks leveraged up like hedge funds, on and on and on. All these entities are all leveraged up like hedge funds.
Yeah, and they had to get a yield. They had, and even that was going back to CalPERS. I mean, they're levering up. What do you say? They're using 20% leverage or 50% leverage just to get a 7% return. But that's, people have to remember that they're still 50% underfunded. or 60%. And that's just by their numbers. I mean, it's staggering the returns they have to get now just to get to a break even. And if they don't, of course, that means people are going to get a haircut. That means less spending. It's kind of this downward, I call it a doom vortex, but basically a feedback loop. And people just, it's all a result of the Fed keeping interest rates artificially low for so long that sooner or later, just the chickens come home to roost. And seems like that's what's happening right now. But going back to that interview with Grant Williams and Fleckenstein, highly suggest that. But I remember that Fleckenstein back in 2016, he wanted to go short, but to your point, he didn't want to battle the Fed liquidity. So he went short the entire system by going long gold and gold miners, if I believe. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes. Yeah, so that's his version of a short. So, because essentially his other part of that thesis is that a lot of central bankers are net accumulating gold. Even though they don't like gold, George, they're still accumulating it because they're voting against the current system. Because maybe they're not getting those currency swap line bailouts, or they're more prudent and not doing those over-leveraged trades that some of these central bankers are doing on foreign currencies and foreign bonds and derivatives. There's actually, and this is really crazy, there's a discount for central banks to trade derivatives. There's a volume trading discount. This was found by my friend James Anderson at SD Bullion a number of years ago for these central banks to trade derivatives on currencies, interest rates, commodities at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. This is a perverse incentive system. There should be less derivatives, not more trading of derivatives.
It's like they're going to Costco for derivatives. It's just, you can't make this stuff up. I think it's so well said, though, Jason. Stagflate, tax, and lie. If you think about if you were in the government position and you had no morals or you had no ethics, like most politicians, of course, I mean, how can that not be the game plan? It's just when you look at the bogus CPI numbers, when you look at the taxes, I mean, I think nothing's a certainty, of course, but I think the probabilities that we're going to have higher taxes in the United States moving forward is extremely high. And then, you know, stagflation, it's what we're seeing right now. It's their only way out of this massive debt problem they have. I think it's just such a great way and such a concise way to describe what their game plan is. Did you see Snyder's last or his second to last interview with Emil on Marxism by chance?
No, I did not. I listened to your video, though, where you summarized it.
Yeah, I'd love to get your take on that, because you've got so many contacts in China. And specifically, what I'd like to get your take on is China sending people into Russia when it collapsed, let's call it early 90s. And their takeaway is that communism wasn't flawed. It's just the way Russia rolled it out was flawed, and that they didn't allow capitalism in Russia long enough. They went basically from, let's call it, feudalism straight to communism instead of this period of capitalism for several decades. And the capitalists have to grow the economy and expand it the way only they can. And that's even according to Marx. And then once the capitalists expand it as far as it can go, the communists need to take over. China's take is that Russia didn't allow that to happen, and that's why it collapsed. And Snyder was insinuating that China, the reason why they've allowed capitalism to, I don't know if you want to call it flourish, but we can go with that word, since the late 1990s, is because they didn't want to make the same mistake that Russia made. But now they're getting to the point that they're trying to maybe, they think that capitalism has taken China as far as it can, and they're trying to pull back the reins. And that's why you see China being so much more authoritarian towards Hong Kong, etc. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it takes two to tango. And I think a lot of U.S. corporations wanted to move their factories out of the U.S. to China to increase profit margins and lower labor costs and not have to pay the workers' pensions. So I think that was the other side of it. China actually was never compliant with World Trade Organization standards. So they've still, 20 years later, have not been compliant with any of the WTO standards. The other problem with the Chinese economy is property rights. So there's very dicey property rights. Property rights are, especially if you're a foreigner, and now an American too, with the xenophobia that's running there with Xi, how things have changed drastically in the last like 4 or 5 years. Things have changed a lot in the last 4 or 5 years. So China, when they initially opened up and had somewhat capitalism, from speaking with friends that were living there, there was the ability to be entrepreneurial, to start a business, to try things out. So there was, as long as you didn't criticize the government, there was not, back then when they first opened things up for decades, there was not a totalitarian surveillance state with hundreds of millions of cameras and social credit score and potentially a government crypto yuan that's probably coming in the not too distant future. So I think China, over the last 10 years, they created a lot of debt, a lot of credit. They spent a lot of it on infrastructure to maintain employment, and a lot of it's wasteful. They created an enormous credit bubble, but I think the amount of freedom in China in the last 4 or 5 years has changed drastically. And I think a lot of my friends who lived in China, including one of my friends who helped, he was a manager who helped open up the General Motors plant, the first one in China, and he left mainland China 2 years ago. So he's back in the US for now. So the writing's on the wall that China is closing down. Now, China has a lot of wealth. Okay, so when China did open up, they accumulated a massive amount of wealth. There was an enormous amount of investment from foreign corporations and American corporations. But the deal that a lot of the American government and other governments and U.S. corporations made, it was not the deal that they thought they were getting. So there was a lot of intellectual property theft, research and development theft, forced technology transfer, forced joint venture deals. And some of these large corporations thought that they would have, you know, many, many millions of sales of certain products. Like, I think Philip Morris thought they were going to be able to easily sell cigarettes in China. I remember in 2008 that they were promoting this joint venture agreement with a Chinese tobacco company to sell their products there. And for years, they just kept pushing it off. I haven't paid attention recently to see if that deal came back on, but for 4 or 5 years, it never happened. So that's the problem with dealing with the Chinese government. Everything is, they don't do what they say, and they're really good at changing the rules, like pretty much every other government.
Right. But so I think that just plays right into what Jeff Snyder was talking about, that this is kind of the Marxist playbook, that you allow capitalism to do its thing. And then at some point in time, when you don't think that capitalism can move the ball forward anymore, that's when the communists come in and basically seize the wealth that the capitalists have created and distribute it amongst the people and take back over the means of production. In their mind, this is a more efficient way moving forward. Obviously,
it's an efficient way of theft.
What I'm saying is that what you're talking about from your perspective and from your contacts really plays into what Snyder was saying almost precisely, that this kind of overall game plan they have. Going back to the market just getting insane and, Portnoy and the just picking three letters for a ticker, and stocks always go up, and buying Hertz bankrupt companies and Nikola, and you can just go down the line. But we know, and most of my viewers know, that the stock market now has no reflection at all of the real economy. And I would argue that it's almost an inverse relationship. But what do you think about the TGA right now going into an election? I think I was talking to Luke Groman the other night. He was saying it's up over $1.7 trillion with a T. And I mean, how does that work if Trump wants to juice the economy and the stock market prior to the election, which, I mean, I don't see why he wouldn't do that. I don't see why any administration wouldn't do that, especially the Trump administration. But I mean, does that take us to 40,000 on the Dow, 50,000? I mean, and then you combine that with this crazy stimulus packages we were talking about with the TRIP Act and everything else, where people are getting $4,000. I think I was laughing over you, people are getting $4,000 just to go on a vacation, basically. And that doesn't include their dependents, by the way. I think they get $500 each as well. But the last stimulus package, so many people use the additional unemployment or just their stimulus check to go and gamble in the stock market and buy the dip. So if that happens again and the stimulus package is $9 trillion or $10 trillion compared to $3 trillion, where does the Dow go, Jason?
I think it's going to be a roller coaster. I think there could be big up moves and then big down moves and then rules, more rules changes and more liquidity injections. As long as the dollar stays relatively strong in that dollar tug of war range where it's not too weak, and or it's in a range, or it's getting, if it's getting too strong, George, if the dollar is getting too strong, this actually, people don't understand this, this actually gives the people here in DC, Congress and the Treasury, a license to do even more. So they could do even more. So if the dollar index goes to, let's say,
why is that, Jason? Can you explain that to me?
Well, they want to weaken the dollar. So,
oh, but you said if the dollar goes up, that it gives them a license to do more.
Because they want to weaken it. So if the dollar is rising, their thought process is that we must weaken it. We must issue more currency units. We must hand out checks. This gives them the justification as Keynesians and neo-Keynesians and neo-mercantilists to try to weaken the currency, to come up with new programs. This is why MMT, George, or MMT Light, whatever you want to call it, was adopted so quickly by the Republicans. The Republicans for the last 2 years in Congress said they wouldn't do it. And then as soon as the economy, the cash flows in the economy stopped and the asset prices fell, the Republicans in Congress folded pretty much like a lawn chair.
Right, right. Yeah, why not just print our way out of anything when we never have to worry about inflation again?
Well, they want a weaker currency. This is the problem. I want a stronger currency. I want more purchasing power. But the people in power who make the decisions, they all want a weaker currency. The problem is all these other countries, all these other central banks also want a weaker currency.
Right. So what do you think is preventing them, meaning like the New York Fed, I'm assuming they do it through their trading desk, going into the FX market? I talked to Lynn about this last night, and just printing up bank reserves to buy foreign debt, to do whatever, to try to artificially lower the dollar in the worldwide market. Why do you think they're not doing that? Like, why would they not want it closer to like 85, 80, something like that?
Well, we might eventually get there. I think they're okay with the dollar tug of war for now. They just panicked when the dollar index got to 102, 103, and it looked like that Brent Johnson's and Raoul Powell from Real Vision, their scenario was going to play out. So they seem okay with the dollar in the current trading range where maybe it gets as high as 99 and then it drops down to around 96, somewhere in those range. I think they're okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so we've got this TGA. If the market, you see this roller coaster, I mean, up and down and just a lot of volatility, what do you think that does, if anything, to the social unrest we're seeing right now in the United States? I'm not there. I'm assuming it's calmed down a little bit since 3 weeks ago with the riots and the looting. But where do you think we go with that here going into an election, which is probably going to be the craziest election of our lifetimes?
So I think the goal from Congress with the extra $600 per week and at the state level for unemployment, the extra $600 per week for some people for their unemployment benefits was to try to prevent the civil unrest. And it doesn't look like it was very successful. So the normal policy measures for the people in power in DC and at the state capitol is to try to double down. They try to double down normally on the same policy and say, we just didn't do enough of it. So I would not be shocked if they try to do more of that. But there are permanent problems right now in the US along race, class, gender, age, and ideology that handing people more checks are not going to fix. So yes, people might buy more stuff. Yes, people might pay off some debt. Yes, people may gamble in the stock market. But these underlying problems with cultural Marxism and the social fabric of the U.S. are not going away by printing over them.
Yeah, and if anything, it might even get worse if the market gets up to, I mean, think about that. The market gets up to, let's say, 40,000 and unemployment goes back up to, I mean, I'm talking about U6 unemployment, gets up over 25%, maybe 30%, while the market's just hitting all-time highs every single day because of all this stimulus. I mean, that's just going to, it's just going to piss people off even more. And then if they're forced to go back to work, that's another tug of war that I think is fascinating, is the people not wanting to go back to work because they're making more money with unemployment. And if Biden gets into the office, how does that work? Do you think he's going to extend these quote unquote benefits just indefinitely and turn it into UBI, or what do you think about that?
Well, eventually it's going to have really negative consequences for the dollar. If the real economy is not generating normal levels of cash flow at all levels of society, and my view on this is there's a big cash flow problem now starting from February and March. So there was cash flow problems before that, servicing debt. Obviously, I've talked about how there's too much total debt in society and it can't all mathematically be paid back. But there was solid amounts of cash flow for real estate prior to February and March. Now we're starting to get where the real economy can roll over, even if people are given stimulus checks, because those forbearances on people's mortgage payments, residential mortgages, commercial real estate mortgages, and then also car payments, those forbearances are going to end unless they're extended in the coming months. And this is brings me back to what worries me about the banks. Now, maybe they will change the bank accounting laws again, or maybe the banks will be able to mark to model whatever they want. But there was an interesting article, not sure if you talked about this in a video yet, from Frank Partnoy. And he used to work on Wall Street. He designed collateralized loan obligations, and then he left Wall Street to go be a professor, I think a law professor, and write finance books. And he just penned this article in the last month or so called the Looming Bank Collapse. And in the article, it talks about collateralized loan obligations. So collateralized loan obligations are this cycle's version of subprime mortgage-backed securities. There's leverage loans that are chopped up and stuffed into there. I've called it toxic sausage. I think you have too. And so this stuff is bad corporate debt. It's so bad, there's not even collateral for it. So it wasn't even good, like a good corporate bond or a junk bond. That's how bad this stuff is. And now they're changing the rules for the banks again. So what can go into these collateralized loan obligations? Because the leveraged loans that were stuffed into these things are all being downgraded rapidly by the ratings agencies, who are normally late to the party at downgrading these things. So when the ratings agencies are downgrading massive amounts of leveraged loans, I think there was 30% downgrades of a lot of these leveraged loans, but we haven't had collateralized loan obligation failures. Now, what worries me though, because of the cash flow problem and problems coming with commercial real estate, residential real estate, is what Frank Partnoy described in the article, how Wells Fargo Bank might have, according to his research, a special investment vehicle, which is basically what Enron did off balance sheet, stuffed with $1 trillion of commercial real estate mortgage-backed securities, leveraged loans, and collateralized loan obligations. If that is true, the next major crisis point, so this cycle's Lehman Brothers or AIG or Bear Stearns, could be Wells Fargo Bank. I think the other problem bank that really worries me, and you've talked about this and Kyle Bass has talked about this, is HSBC Bank. They have so many enemies now.
Not only that, they got 30%, 40%. They're completely consolidated into Hong Kong.
So they got Ronan Manley wrote a very interesting article, very detailed article in April about how HSBC Bank, the gold market, the paper gold market blew up in London on the LBMA, and HSBC Bank needed 170 tons of physical gold for bailout alone from the Bank of England, who is furious about this. But the Bank of England is also furious about HSBC Bank for massive amounts of dollar-denominated debt loans they gave to Chinese banks and the People's Bank of China. Kyle Bass has claimed that it's $500 billion. I believe European banks, including HSBC, also sold Chinese banks a massive amount of derivatives for dollar swaps. And then on top of that, HSBC Bank has major, major problems with, there was a documentary from, excuse me, there was a documentary from Netflix's Dirty Money series. And in the documentary, it talks about, you know, knowingly laundering drug cartel money, organized crime money, and terrorist organization money. And then HSBC Bank also turned over evidence to avoid charges on that. They turned over evidence to the U.S. Department of Justice against Huawei and the Huawei CFO. So there's a lot of very powerful, HSBC Bank has very powerful enemies with the Chinese government, the Bank of England, and also the U.S. Department of Justice.
Yeah, and just so everyone knows, if you buy the GLD, that entity that Jason just described so well, is the custodian of your gold, or the gold that is supposed to be backing the GLD. That's why I always, whenever someone asks me about the GLD, oh, should I just buy the GLD instead of gold in my IRA? I'm like, yeah, you might want to think twice about that one, to say the least. All right. So let's go into, I know we're running short on time here. This has been a fantastic conversation, by the way, but I always like to get your opinion on not just gold, but the gold miners and everyone in the opportunity in that space, because you've studied this so well. You've predicted a lot of things that we've seen play out, and you've got so much of this awesome content on your Patreon page. So I can't encourage people enough to go to your Patreon page, check that out, go subscribe to your YouTube channel. I know your YouTube channel is Wall Street for Main Street. Is the Patreon page the same name?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, you guys have to check this out if you're interested in the miners or precious metals, anything like that. But Jason, can you give us your overview of some of the work that you've done there and then where you see it going, let's say in the next year to 5 years?
So for safety, I prefer the larger precious metal royalty and streaming companies because they have diversified portfolios of cash flow. With gold stocks, really since March when we had that forced puke margin call liquidation event,
yeah,
all the dips in gold stock charts for the major gold stock ETFs, which is GOAU, which is probably the best one, or the two Sprott ones, or the top gold stocks like Franco Nevada or Wheaton Precious Metals, Royal Gold, Sandstorm Gold, those types, the dips are being bought very strongly. There is very little corrections in the charts if you go back and look. So smart money is seriously accumulating physical gold and silver, and also the highest quality royalty and streaming companies and the best gold and silver mining stocks right now. So the dips are being bought. This is a clear bull market. The long-term chart for the gold price has formed a giant cup with a handle. So we just broke above 1800. If there was not paper price manipulation in the gold market, and it's extremely well documented by the Gold Antitrust Action Committee. In fact, things are so bad with the paper price market that there's a RICO, there's RICO charges against lower level and mid-level managers for JP Morgan for spoofing and precious metal market manipulations over the last couple of years. So the U.S. Department of Justice is still supposedly working on an extensive RICO case against this. For those people who say that there is no precious metal market manipulation, there's a RICO case that's going on. As far as I know, it's still going on. So ideally, what we should see, if the market was functioning somewhat normally, we would see gold at $2,000 an ounce in 6 months or less. If it doesn't happen, my portfolio is actually set up to, in the long run, still benefit from that, because the companies that I own, the shares of the companies that I own, when the gold price actually doesn't go up too much, or the silver price corrects or is flat for a while, they just do more deals for cash flow. So it's actually the business model for a larger royalty and streaming company is actually set up very similarly to a rental property owner. So what a rental property owner, as you know this, George, but your listeners might not, is they take out a mortgage on a rental property and they generate a positive return, and then they pay back their property taxes and their mortgage payment. And then once they pay off the debt on that rental property, they do it again. It's like Monopoly. And so very similar business model to what these larger royalty and streaming companies do with a rental property owner who is just accumulating rental properties. These royalty and streaming companies just buy more small royalties and streams, which are 2% to 9% of revenues on a gold or silver mine or a copper mine, depending upon how they do the transaction. And so they have a portfolio of cash flow, which is very similar to how a rental property real estate investor would operate.
Right. And you really take a deep dive on those as well. So you're thinking we're in a gold bull market. Where do you see this going? I mean, long term, obviously. I mean, you know, I think, have you read that report in Gold We Trust? I'm kind of going off topic here. That just dawned on me.
No, I haven't read it, but a lot depends on if the Fed has to do really drastic measures to weaken the dollar. Because of this dollar tug of war, if the dollar gets too strong and some of these other spending programs the Fed and Treasury and Congress start issuing can't weaken the dollar enough, I call it the nuclear option. Some of the crazy scenarios that I've heard, Jim Rickards has talked about the Fed announcing that they're just going to print dollars and start buying gold and move the gold price up. That's a possible scenario. I'm not saying it's likely, it's possible. Yeah. You also have what FDR did in 1934, where he devalued in one giant amount, he devalued the dollar against gold. So that's a possibility. And then you have the Plaza Accord, which is another possibility, but that would be a dollar devaluation, but not against gold. And then you have what the British Empire did from 1931 into the 1970s, where they just randomly and at random times, they announced devaluations of their currency. But ultimately, this means that we're getting towards the end because they're running out of ways, they're running out of tricks.
Yeah, and all those ways that you just mentioned would definitely increase the price of gold in nominal terms. But I mean, do you really see it going up in real terms over the next 5 years?
Well, the problem for American citizens is the higher the gold price goes, if we get $5,000 an ounce gold or $10,000 an ounce gold, there is no long-term capital gains tax for owning gold. Daniel Amerman, who helped design mortgage-backed securities, a former investment banker, he used to write extensive articles on this in 2008, 9, 10, and 11. They're called the hidden inflation, the hidden tax on gold. So the tax structure for American citizens owning physical gold, we don't get to lock in a 10% or 15% long-term capital gains tax. So if gold does go to $5,000 or $10,000 an ounce, we don't get to keep most of those capital gains. So I think that's part of the problem. The incentive now for the government is to devalue the currency. This is what historically empires do. They prefer stagflation tax and lie normally to hyperinflation because most people don't notice. It's the modern version of clipping coins.
Yeah, exactly. All right, buddy. Well, fantastic interview. I sure appreciate your time. For my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, all the awesome, amazing content you create. I know you have incredible live streams. I try to hop on there whenever I see the alert notification on my browser and check it out. But where can they go to get all that awesome info?
Yeah, I think YouTube is probably not giving as many alert notifications. Hopefully I don't get the Stefan Molyneux penalty, but I'm doing my best. My YouTube channel is WALSTFORMAINST, Wall Street for Main Street. Both of the spellings, if you type it out full or the partial, work there. And my Patreon links are all on the YouTube channel.
Okay, fantastic, Jason. I can't wait to do it again.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.